supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Support for Voices in the Family is made possible in part by the generous support of Devereaux, the nation's largest nonprofit provider of behavioral health care for children, adolescents, and adults with developmental and intellectual disabilities, behavioral disorders, and mental illness. Devereaux operates at 15 centers in 11 states throughout the country.
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to this very special edition of Voices in the Family. Linny, the beautiful girl, in the title of Rachel Simon's best-selling new novel, grew up in the 60s and was considered defective. That's why she was brought up in what was called the Pennsylvania State School for the Incurable and Feeble-Minded. The novel opens when Linny and her beloved Homan have escaped the inhumane treatment of the school. Unfortunately, this is not entirely fiction. These kinds of institutions existed throughout the country during much of the 20th century, and right here in Pennsylvania was the infamous Eastern Pennsylvania Institution for the Feeble-Minded and Epileptic, now known as the Pennhurst State School. We've been encouraging our listeners to read the novel so that we could have a book club format today. We've got the author of the novel, Rachel Simon, with us, and we hope you'll have questions for her. Unfortunately, we're having a great deal of difficulty with our phone lines, and we would love you to email us instead, if you can. We're at voices@whyy.org. Again, that's voices@whyy.org, and please email your question. You can also try to call us. We'll see if it works. Our number is 888-477-9499. Well, in addition to Rachel Simon, later in the show, we're going to hear from Jim Conroy, who is the principal investigator of the Pennhurst study, which looked at how people made the transition from institutions to group homes. We'll also be talking with Jean Searle, who has firsthand experience with an institution of this sort. Rachel, welcome to the show.
Hi, it's so wonderful to be here, Dan.
So, let's go to the beginning of the book. It starts out in 1968 when two people arrive at the door of a retired widowed schoolteacher named Martha. Martha, years ago, gave birth to a child who was defective, that's in quotes, and died. Martha's husband, she said, was never the same. So tell us about the two people who arrive at Martha's door.
The two people who arrive are Linny, who's also known as Beautiful Girl, and Homan, who is actually a John Doe. He's John Doe number 42. Nobody actually knows that his name is Homan. He's African-American and deaf. He does not use his voice. Linny is white and has a developmental disability. She also doesn't use her voice, although their reasons are different. They are in love. Linny is younger than Homan. She was put in the institution by her parents when she was very young and has been there through her teenage years and is now 18. Homan got caught by the authorities and put there because he was erroneously labeled as feeble-minded, a term that people used for what we would now call intellectual or developmental disabilities, and he was just thrown in there as many deaf people were.
So that's who the people were.
Yes.
Tell us about the institution they escaped from.
The institution they escaped from, I did a lot of research, and I'm based on a number of details from a number of different institutions, including Pennhurst, which I went and visited after it had closed, but also did a lot of reading and went to documentaries and got information from them. And I chose to name this one the Pennsylvania State School for the Incurable and Feeble-Minded, and that's the kind of name that seems absolutely outrageous now, but as we just heard from your introduction, it was the kind of name that really was used. And I set it in a rural area in the northern part of Pennsylvania, which was an area where I lived when I was a child for a brief period. And a lot of these places were also out in rural areas. They were kind of meant to not be noticed. You were meant to not know they existed. And they tended to be rather self-sufficient, with the people who worked there often being the people who lived there if they were, quote-unquote, higher functioning. So basically it was slave labor there as well as some paid staff people. And that's why I chose to put it where I did. But it's a made-up location and a made-up institution.
You emphasized when we spoke with you that it was important to distinguish between mental institutions and institutions for people with developmental disabilities. Why?
Thank you. I really am so glad you brought that up.
You told me, Rachel.
Well, thank you. I'm glad you did. When I was growing up, I have a sister who has a developmental disability, and she was raised at home. She was not raised in an institution. I'd heard of these places called institutions, and like many people, I confused them with institutions for people with mental health issues. So I was thinking of the sort of place that we think of for One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest or Girl Interrupted, that kind of thing. But then the expose started in the early 1970s where I lived. In this area, they started a little earlier, as we'll discuss later. And I started to realize, oh, there was this whole parallel system of institutions for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. So people who had my sister's disability, which at the time was called mental retardation, not words that are used anymore, but also people with autism, people with epilepsy, cerebral palsy, and people who were John Doe'd, like my character Homan, who were no one knew who they were, and they were just dumped in there. And it's a completely different system, and people were often in there for life, as opposed to places for people with mental illness.
We've been using a label here, intellectual developmental disability. First, tell us about your sister, her level of functioning, and intellectual disabilities is on a wide continuum,
yes,
too. So tell us about your sister and tell us what that word means.
Oh, well, boy, how many days do we have for that? So my sister, her name is Beth. She's 11 months younger than I am. I love her a lot. She was raised with the family. Before she was a year old, she was diagnosed with the term I won't say again, but the initials were MR. And at that time, she didn't move or walk or talk, was not terribly functional, and the doctors didn't know how far she would progress or what was going to happen. My parents were very adamant about her not going into an institution, so she was raised at home, and given everything that my parents could give her, that they gave all the rest of us, so education, the feeling of freedom out in the community, we were very much told she was never to be hidden from the world. And she did move and walk and talk and talk and talk and talk, and she's still quite a talker.
Well, you wrote your breakthrough novel about her riding the bus with
right.
my sister. It became a Hallmark movie.
Right. And I should clarify, it's actually a memoir, not a novel, because it's all true.
Sorry, my mistake.
Well, that's all right. It's my sister, as my sister would say, it's all true. So she would be considered by some people high functioning. Does now live independently and moves about in the world.
So what does the word mean?
What does the word intellectual disability mean?
Yeah.
Well, I am not the scientist sitting at this table, and I think Jim Conroy will be able to define that for us better.
Okay, all right, we'll postpone it then.
Yeah, I think the basic idea that I've come to is that my sister developed in a slower way and continues to be noticeably different in many ways. On the other hand, she doesn't think slowly. She thinks very quickly. Mm. And she will call you on your stuff, and she will see through you very easily. And she will wrap you around her finger if she possibly can, and she will figure out a way.
Yeah, wonderful. the voice you're hearing is Rachel Simon. And we're talking about her best-selling novel, The Story of Beautiful Girl. We'd love to hear from you. As I said earlier, we're having difficulty with our phones, but I'd like you to try them anyway. 888-477-9499, and love to hear from you via email. We're at voices@whyy.org. That's voices@whyy.org. So Rachel, you've been lecturing around the country as a follow-up to Riding the Bus with my sister. And in one of your experiences, you picked up a book called God Knows His Name, The True Story of John Doe, number 24. Was that the impetus for this book?
It was part of the impetus for this book. It introduced me to the character who I eventually turned into the character of Homan. So it placed him in my mind and introduced me to the whole idea of African Americans who were deaf and sometimes getting caught in the system like this. My sister happens to have a boyfriend who's also African American, so I really related to that very, very strongly. That was one aspect of it. And another aspect of it from my traveling with speaking for Riding the Bus with my sister is one of the cool things that happens when you write a memoir is people feel they know you because they've read your book, and they come up to you at your events and self-disclose very instantly. So people started immediately telling me all about their lives and crying. I'm sure this happens to you because you've also written memoirs.
Yeah.
And I'm sure you take it as seriously as I do. And frequently people would tell me stories that were, in fact, not the story my sister had lived. My sister had lived at home, and people would tell me stories about living in an institution or having a family member in one or working in one. And they were very overwrought. And I just started to feel this really needs to be told. But there was no way I was going to do it in nonfiction because I didn't experience it as a family member. And turning to fiction not only solved that problem, but it also gave me the freedom to write from the points of view of multiple characters, including Beautiful Girl and Homan, so I could write from the point of view of characters with disabilities.
In the novel and all throughout the book, we see the humanity of all the main characters. I wonder how, well, maybe you could tell me how Linny wound up in this institution. What were her so-called disabilities?
She developed more slowly. I actually based a lot of her early life on things with my sister. She did have a temper my sister didn't have, and she also had a lot of difficulty with her when other people would cry. She was very porous. She would take their crying into herself and then start getting very out of control emotionally. She was very slow in learning to read and speak and get out of diapers. And her parents, this was in the 1950s, and her mother was willing to be patient with this, and her father was less inclined, and there was family pressure for them to consider this other option of the term my family used to use is putting her away. That was the expression we used in the family. And the mother becomes increasingly worried about what to do and eventually reaches the point where she's pregnant with twins and is just very strongly advised to put this child away because it'll make things difficult for everyone.
I wonder what it was like for parents back then.
I hope we have a caller who tells us, because I've spoken, well, obviously to many, many people who have, and it was wrenching, and they were also told it was the right thing, and they strongly believed it was the right thing to do. And they were in an era where there were no services in a lot of places. There wasn't special education, and they really didn't have options unless the family was going to throw their lives into working with this individual.
Let's see if we can get a caller on. We've got Laura on the line. Hi, Laura.
Hi, how are you?
Okay.
Hi, Laura.
What can we do? We've got to keep this brief, and okay, we've got to cross our fingers that it works.
Okay, quickly. I am still not happy with the term cognitively disabled. I know we've gotten rid of some of the negative connotations of MR, but my term I always come to is disabled. Because they are differently abled, and it doesn't seem, and all children would fall under that category. And I just wondered, I just questioned the name. Is it still, because you were talking about your sister and how her different talents, and she's differently abled, and I just wonder what you think about that.
Okay. Thanks so much, Laura. Rachel?
I think in this case I defer to what my sister wants to refer to her disability as, and I've talked with her about it, and what she'll say is, I have special needs. And I have said to her, is that how I should describe you to people? And she said, yes. So my sister, I don't think she thinks of herself as differently abled any more than she would look at everybody sitting in a room and think that. It's just people are who they are, and she is someone with special needs. So I, someone else may say, oh, that term works for me, but for my sister, that's the term that works for her.
Yeah, yeah, and I still haven't found a label for me other than just neurotic. I mean, I don't, you know, because special needs doesn't work for me because it means my needs are special and yours, well, not so much.
Yeah, well, we could get into
that
conversation.
You've got to live with. Let's take another call. We've got Mike on the line. Hi, Mike.
Yeah, I just want to know, how can you get your peers to not view people with mental disabilities as inferior? Because I was raised by a grandmother who taught people with that were mentally challenged, and she pressed us from the time we were very young to never view them as inferior or different, and that it's just the way God made them, and God made them unique. And I just wondered how you could get people to not view them that way or not feel pity for them and explain to them that it's just a matter of a physical thing and it has nothing to do with their mental capabilities.
I will tackle that question, if I may, Rachel. I had an experience Saturday at a restaurant. I was there with a friend of mine, and I ordered a tuna steak that was thick, too thick for me to cut with a fork. I can't hold silverware very well, and I can't hold a knife at all. So I had to ask my companion to cut the tuna for me. And the waitress came over, and she said, oh, my God, I'm so sorry. I should have realized. Now, that had never happened before to me in a restaurant, that a waitress would notice in advance. And then when the tea came at the end of the meal, she put the bag in the tea and waited a few minutes and then poured it for me. And I commented to her how much I appreciated it. And she said, oh, I understand. My grandmother has MS and she's in a wheelchair. So that's a long answer to Mike's question, that how do we cut down on it? How do we get respect? It's through exposure that we're all teachers. Like it or not, we're teachers. And how we carry what we have teaches everything. And the more we're out there, the more people learn. I don't think you can teach it intellectually. You, Rachel?
Well, you know, of course, I've spent my whole life fighting this battle, my whole life. And for me, part of how I do it is through my writing. What can I bring to the table? And I'm a writer. And so writing about my sister and then writing a novel from the points of view of characters with disabilities where you enter their hearts and their souls and their minds and see the world as they see it. I've had a lot of people finish the story Beautiful Girl and get in touch and say, I am now seeing the world completely differently.
Yeah,
and I'm
going
to talk to the guy at the Acme now.
That book, more than any other thing I've read, did that. I mean, that really nailed it. Well, we've got to take a short break now. When we come back, we're going to talk with Jim Conroy, who's the founder and president of the Center for Outcome Analysis. He looked at what happened with the residents at Pennhurst. We're also going to be talking with Gene Searle, who's a longtime self-advocate and a force within the disability rights movement. And we'll also be talking with Rachel. Give us a call. Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. And please email us. We're at voices@whyy.org. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY FM.
Parents, do you feel like you are losing your teenager to drugs and alcohol? If substance abuse is causing changes in your relationship with your child and you don't know where to go, the Family Training Program is conducting a research study that may be able to help. If eligible, you will be invited to individual sessions with a family specialist, which may help you regain control of your family. This study is held in Philadelphia by the Treatment Research Institute. For details, 877-I-WORRY-2 or IAmConcerned.org. The Family Training Program supports WHYY.
This is Marty Moskowain. As our fiscal year comes to a close on June 30th, we thank you for being with us through this year of uncertain funding. Now, as we begin a new fiscal year, we ask for your support. Your support helps to provide the funds necessary to broadcast and produce local programs like Radio Times and Newsworks.org. Do your part now to propel WHYY into the next fiscal year. Visit WHYY.org, and thank you.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We've been talking with Rachel Simon about her best-selling new novel, The Story of Beautiful Girl, which is based in part on what institutions were really like for those with developmental and intellectual disabilities. We'll continue our discussion with Rachel, but now we're going to bring on Jim Conroy, who is a principal investigator at the Pennhurst study, which looked at what happened to these residents as they moved from institutions to group homes. We're also going to be talking with Jean Searle, who's a longtime self-advocate and a force within the disability rights movement. Jim, let's start with you. The whole idea of segregating and institutionalizing people with developmental disabilities was not a hostile decision. It was a decision made somewhere in the mid-1800s. It was imported from Europe. What was the rationale?
It certainly was not a hostile decision. It's a wonderful example of best intentions. Again, we have so many of these, but here what was intended was to take people with differences, what was then called, up until the 1930s, idiot, imbecile, and moron was the terminology for people with intellectual disabilities. Take those people and put them far away from centers of population and farm-like environments and protect them and keep them separate.
So that was the rationale. I read that in 1908, right here in Pennsylvania, in Spring City, Pennhurst was formed for the, quote, detention of people with intellectual developmental disabilities. And the people with the disabilities actually built that institution.
In fact, I know a gentleman who laid some of the cornerstones back in the 1900s, early 1900s, but Pennhurst was built and opened by the state legislature in 1908, and it became overcrowded within a few years and continues to be overcrowded.
It was built for 700, yes?
Initially, yes. But at its peak, it had almost 4,000.
The institution became infamous for its mistreatment of the residents. What was it like in the beginning?
I think the worst period of time for institutions like Pennhurst, and we had 260 of them across the country, some say 293. We still do have institutions like them, but at the worst, when they were the most overcrowded, it was really inhumane. I drove to Pennhurst in my father's Chevy in 1970 as a young man and drove away after just a half a day crying, seeing people in huge rooms, mostly naked, hitting each other and themselves, being hosed instead of showered because it was easier. No one had their own clothing or their own toothbrush. And my parents asked me what was wrong when I got back to Washington, and I said, I just saw a place with 3,500 people that we wouldn't put our dog for the weekend.
You said institutions like that still exist?
They do. We have about 150 in the United States. They're much smaller. They're much improved. And yet, some of the research I've done all my life is to find out, can big segregated places like that really be good for people or not?
You have an answer?
I'm afraid I do. It looks like not. There's just nothing you can do to place people in a segregated setting and make it humane and fun and decent and something that people wake up looking forward to.
I want to comment on Rachel's book. It began in 1968. Now, this is the same year Bill Baldini, a local TV reporter, did a series on Pennhurst called Suffer the Children. I saw that series, and it was so hard to watch, and I know it was hard for him to do this. You could see it in his face. You accompanied him. there?
Well, I didn't get there till 1970, 2 years after. But Bill was the first to do any of these stories in the United States, and it was landmark, and it changed everything. Yeah. And in fact, his work was later sent around the country to other affiliates, and people followed up on the story, such as Geraldo at Willowbrook on Staten Island. It was a follow-up to Bill Baldini. What Bill Baldini saw in 1968 is exactly what I saw in 1970. So we now have lunch every so often and talk about the old days, and I think we're all very happy that those old days are gone.
We've got some audio from that 1968 expose on Pennhurst by Bill Baldini. The segment of the series was narrated not by Bill Baldini, because what we're told is it was a five-part series, and by the fifth part, Bill Baldini was so exhausted, physically, mostly, emotionally, spiritually, that he couldn't do it. So this segment was narrated by the late, great television anchor, John Facenda. Let's listen.
The sickening and almost unviewable conditions of the institution is largely due to overcrowding and the lack of personnel to provide elementary care. In many cases, children churn in their own filth for only one reason, lack of assistance. The ones that speak detest the inhumane conditions and hunger for the slightest sign of affection. However, some of them have become so callous to their plight, they've all but given up. They are alone, alone in a world that seems to lack all compassion. In conclusion, TV10 would like to make certain constructive recommendations. Number one, the state must take the necessary steps to alleviate the overcrowding at Pennhurst. Of its 2,800 patients, half of whom are from Philadelphia, 900 of them should be transferred to a different institution. Number two, more physicians are needed to treat both the physical and mental needs of the patients. Three, attendance pay should be increased from the present $75 per week to at least $100 per week. Four, a crash program is needed to refurbish old buildings, and new ones should be built to replace the ones that should be condemned. Five, there are 900 women in Pennhurst. However, there is no gynecologist on the full-time staff. Six, there are only 11 teachers employed at the institution, and none of them is certified in special education. Even though some choose to degrade and castigate the children, a number of the patients manage to hang on and maintain their faith in other human beings, as well as something of a higher order.
That was John Facenda. He was following up, doing the fifth segment of a five-part series done in 1968, started by local reporter Bill Baldini. We're talking about what institutions were like in the 20th century, for those with people who have developmental and intellectual disabilities. My guests are Jim Conroy. He's a principal investigator in the study at Pennhurst that looked at what happened to these individuals as they left Pennhurst to go into group homes. I'm also joined by Jean Searle, who we'll hear from in just a minute. She's a longtime self-advocate and has a personal experience with these institutions. And what got this whole discussion started was Rachel Simon's breathtaking new book. It's called Story of Beautiful Girl, and she joins us here in the studio also. Jim, those who were sent to Pennhurst, did they have a choice?
No. Legally, they were called voluntary admissions, but there was no other option in those days. In the 1950s, as Rachel said, there was nothing else. Children with disabilities weren't allowed into our public schools. Imagine that. That changed right here because of Pennhurst in 1972. A lawsuit was filed to get our public schools open to children with all kinds of abilities, as one of the callers said, different abilities. And that changed the world. Later, we've had changes since then, the Americans with Disabilities Act, and most of our institutions have downsized and closed. So the world has changed immensely, and it's a good thing.
Those dates you throw out are kind of breathtaking. 1972. It's like it was yesterday. I mean, it's, you know, it's recent times. You know, we like to think of this treatment as, you know, a century ago, but it's recent history.
And there's a lawsuit in Pennsylvania now, just settled, to close the last five institutions that were Pennhurst's sister institutions here in Pennsylvania.
Well, I want to talk with you, Gene Searle. I've wanted to talk with you for a while now. So you were 12 years old when you were sent to a similar institution. Where were you sent?
I was sent to Allied Services and a place called Stillmeadow.
Where was that?
Up in Scranton.
Do you know why you were sent there? Did you back then know why you were sent?
No.
So what was it like?
It was like going to prison. It was like you couldn't do anything. You were trapped. You couldn't leave. It was like, you know, being in prison.
Were you housed with other girls your age?
Yes. Yes. Can I just go back 1 second?
Sure.
When I was at Allied Services, they had what you call door cottages. They had one for men, one for women, and one for girls. When I was 12 years old, I was in the girls, and then as I got older, they moved me to different cottages.
What were the cottages like?
It was like living with a whole bunch of strangers, because I didn't know anybody. It was like going to a whole new family living situation, and it was just not what I expected or what I thought it was.
What was your family like?
My parents were both disabled. My dad was in the Army. He was disabled when he was in service. My mom was heavy drinker and heavy smokers, and they couldn't take care of. They had 7 children with disabilities, so they couldn't take care of us.
What do you have? What do you call yourself? Developmentally disabled, special needs, or just Gene?
Just Gene.
Good. I just wanted to be careful here. Gene, I read and we talked about horror stories here about these institutions where people are kept in cribs and broken bones untreated. I got some of this information from Jim's writing. People being showered by getting hosed down in groups. Is that what happened to you?
Yes. Yes. It was like every woman got lined up one by one, and they were showered one at a time.
So despite all the strict rules, you fell in love.
I did.
Tell us about it.
I met a guy. We fell mad in love with each other, and we promised each other that we were going to spend our lives together. We wanted to get married and have a family and, you know, do stuff like normal family do, like normal people do. And so one day I found out that I was pregnant, and before I could even tell the father I was pregnant, he took off with somebody else.
Were you heartbroken?
I was. I was disappointed.
And what happened to the baby?
I gave the baby up for adoption.
Yeah.
Well, actually, the institution told me I could have had an abortion. I could give it to my family, but I decided to give it up for adoption.
Yeah. Rachel, I'm struck because this is very similar. You know, Linny was pregnant when she showed up at
Martha's.
Thank you. Martha's house.
Yes.
You know, I'm struck by the similarities.
Yes, it's pretty amazing because the story is fiction and came absolutely out of nowhere, out of my pen. I was in a sad state one day and sat down to start writing, and there was Martha, and there was the knock on her door, and there was Linny and Homan, and they had the baby, and I understood the baby had been conceived in the institution, unlike with Gene, as a result of a sexual assault. And the story then follows what happens to the baby and Martha, beautiful girl, and Homan. And after I sold the book and was getting to know Jim and Gene, who I hadn't known previously, Jim left me a phone message one morning, or no, it was an email one morning, as I was on my way to meet my publisher and talk with them about the book. He sent an email saying, "You must meet Jean. She is a beautiful girl. She has the same story. She had to give this child up for adoption." It's shocking, shocking.
Jean, tell us when you got out, how you got out, how old you were.
I got out June 9th of 84. I got out, it was very, I guess, weird for me, because when I got out, I was asked to testify on behalf of Pennhurst. Pennhurst would have been my third institution if I was still in the institution. If Pennhurst was still open, I would be there. But I got out under Judge Broderick's court order, him and I became really good friends.
Mm. Mm. So what have you been doing since? How'd you get out? I mean, not how'd you get out. Where have you been living?
Well, since I got out, I was living in a COA for 13 years. Then I moved to my own apartment. Then I was living with Fairy Living for a while. And then I decided to be on my own. I'm now on my own. I have been traveling all over the state by myself. I'm writing the book, like Rachel is, and I've been just talking around the state about different disability issues.
How is your life?
It's good.
Yeah, you like your life?
Yeah, yeah.
That's a wonderful story of resilience. It's extraordinary. I also want to comment to you, young lady. You laugh really easily and well. It's really something special that you carry around.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you for laughing at some of my silly comments.
Well, not only do you have silly ones, so does Jim, so.
Well, we've got to take another break. We've got some callers. We've got some emails that I want to get to, and I want to try to involve as many people as possible on the show. And I do want to get back to your book. We've had this book club. We've asked all of our listeners to read the book, and I want to give them time to come in and comment on the book. We've been talking with Jim Conroy. He was the principal investigator in the Pennhurst study, which looked at what happened with these individuals as they moved from institutions to group homes. And Jean Searle, who's been in such an institution for many years, too many years, and she's now a self-advocate and really a force in the disability rights movement. Our number is 888-477-9499, and our email address is voices@whyy.org. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. That's right here on WHYY-FM.
The Wistar Institute is proud to support WHYY-FM. I'm Dr. Russell Kaufman, president of the Wistar Institute, a world leader in biomedical research right here in Philadelphia. Today at Wistar, scientists can explore our entire set of genes to answer the question, what causes cancer? This research guides us to design individual therapies for different types of cancer. The Wistar Institute, today's discoveries, tomorrow's cures, online at wistar.org.
As the so-called Arab Spring stretches into summer, Muammar Gaddafi maintains his grip on power in Libya. Almost 100 days since NATO began bombing, we'll look ahead at the continued international response in Libya and the status of opposition forces fighting Gaddafi on the ground. The latest in the battle for Libya, next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. The Story of Beautiful Girl, a best-selling novel by Rachel Simon, who's the author, is a love story, a story of finding one's way home, for whatever that means. And it's a story of what we as a country and maybe the rest of the world did to people who had intellectual and developmental disabilities in the past century. I'm here with Rachel Simon. I'm also joined by Jim Conroy, who was very involved in the closing down of Pennhurst, and Jean Searle, who's been in institutions like Pennhurst for a very long time. Rachel, we've got an email. Maybe it's for Jim. He or she said, in an institution with MR and cerebral palsy, this is right from the email, the institution lied to her parents about her progress. When we visited, we saw how terrible the conditions were. Did these institutions lie to parents about what was happening, Jim?
I'm afraid they did. Any institution in human affairs will keep trying to keep itself going, and they will tell stories that are there to their advantage. And of course, parents want the best for their children. Any parent does. And so when bad things happened, there was a tremendous tendency to cover up.
Yeah, we know about that from this Pennhurst trial. We've got, let's go to the phones. We've got Mark on the line. Hi, Mark.
Hello?
Yes, hi.
Oh, hello, Dr. Dan. I'd like to say welcome to your panel, but I would like to address this comment especially to Rachel Simon. I've had the pleasure of riding the bus with my sister, and just recently a friend of mine recommended to me, oh, you've got to read this book, The Story of Beautiful Girl. And as I was going through it, you know, you've got the escape in the beginning, the giving of the baby to Martha, Lenny is recaptured, people think that Homan has actually died.
Don't give us
the punchline.
Okay,
I'd love to hear your comment.
As the story goes on, as I'm going through the story, the one thing that impressed me the most was, Ms. Simon, you've humanized developmentally disabled folks in ways that many people may not be aware of, because this is simply one of the most powerful love stories I have ever had the pleasure to read. And I would just like to say that to you, and thank you for that.
Yeah, thank you, Mark. And
thank you.
I want to tell you, I have thanked Rachel Simon for the very same thing over and over again. Rachel, the character Homan, how did you get that name?
it's a small story. I'm going to have to give a tiny bit away here. So if you don't want to know anything, turn your radio off for the next 2 minutes.
Don't turn your radio off.
Okay. Okay. In trying to figure out what his storyline would be once everybody gets separated at the end of the first chapter, and that's not giving anything away, I had enough of a classical education in literature to be very drawn to a lot of classical mythology. And one of the storylines that I've always been drawn to is the Odyssey. I realized that his storyline could follow the Odyssey and would help me with plotting. And I wanted to have a name that would allude to the Odyssey, but Odysseus was a little too overt. Ulysses had already been taken. And one day I went out for a very long walk while I was mulling this over. I happened to be house-sitting for my father, who lives in central Pennsylvania, and one of the places where I go walking is a mountain there, a very rural mountain. And I am friends with an old lady who lives in a farmhouse on the side of the road, and I stopped off to visit her, and we had a wonderful conversation. And as we were talking, it suddenly dawned on me, her last name is Homan. And I thought, oh, that's so perfect. Homan, Homer, human,
right.
Home. And it all fell into place.
Beautiful. Hey, Jim, I want to follow up on the critical question with you. When I read over your materials, I read that you were frightened, reticent about closing down these institutions so quickly, because when we closed down the mental health institutions, it was a disaster and remains to be. I mean, so many people on the streets. So what did happen with the people who left Pennhurst and similar institutions?
Well, that's right. It's wildly different, the two situations. In the mental health field, it's a national disgrace. There are publications all over the place, and 500,000 people got out. Now we have 300,000 people in our jails and prisons, 100,000 in nursing homes, and no one knows how many homeless. But in the field of intellectual and developmental disabilities, it was totally, utterly different, because every person at Pennhurst had to have a place to live and something to do during the day before they left. And that's what was done. Every person who left had a place to live, staff to help them, and something to do every day. And so after Pennhurst closed, it was a happy thing to be able to say that my team from Temple University had visited every single person face-to-face, and not one was homeless.
That was recent?
That's going back to 92 when I left Temple and started my own nonprofit.
That's kind of amazing, isn't it?
It was unprecedented. No one knew what would happen. And we got the joy of finding out.
So what did you do right that they did wrong?
Well, it's really very simple. When folks were released from mental institutions for mental illness, they were given 30 days of medication and a pat on the back. They had no place set up for them to live, no family contacts, usually torn asunder. They had nothing.
Well, so, wait a minute. I want to challenge that, because I got into the field in 1969, and that was the beginning of the community mental health movement. So theoretically, we were supposed to follow them with short-term inpatient and outpatient, and of course, that never happened.
But you're exactly right. The 1963 Community Mental Health Act was designed to put in place things in every community that would support people who had difficulty with mental problems.
There's something going on to honor the memory of Pennhurst?
Indeed. We think that so many things started right here in Pennsylvania that we should begin to remember these painful things, never forget them, never repeat them. And Pennhurst is the epicenter of this as a civil rights movement.
Hmm. Rachel, I want to talk about your relationship with the character, with characters, with the book. You said you cried while you were writing the book.
I wrote this book in a total isolation. I had one friend who knew the first few chapters, and then I said to her that, you know, enough, get out of the book. And then no one else even knew it existed. And I sat in a rocking chair right by hand, and I wrote it for a year and a half. And I knew where it was going, unlike the reader. But there were many, many scenes where I would just cry, and I had this box of tissues next to me. I thought about the characters constantly. I have to say, even though I finished the writing a year ago, I am still thinking about these characters constantly. And I think most people who've read the book continue to... I mean, these characters are totally alive. These are real people.
And the tears?
Do you want me to define what kind of tears they were?
No. When did you cry? What made you cry?
There were moments of sorrow, but there were also moments of triumph. Yeah. And tears come from the greatest depths of despair and the greatest moments of joy.
Rachel, right from the beginning, we know that Linny and Homan loved each other. We know that they loved this baby and would do anything for the baby. Love is a theme throughout the book, and I wonder if you did it partly to confront the assumption that people with intellectual disabilities were not capable of love.
Oh, gosh, yeah, absolutely. There's a lot of taboos and misunderstandings, and one has to do with emotions and love. Another has to do with sexuality, and another, which we won't have time for, is spirituality. In fact, that little clip from the Baldini piece touched on that, and that these are people who do have a place in their heart for the divine. So that is also something I went into in the book.
Jean, Howard, do you consider yourself a spiritual person? Do you have a higher power? Do you have thoughts about the way the world works? And
When I got out of the institution, at first I had spiritual feelings, but I still do. But now I go to church and I, you know, ask the Lord to help me out with stuff that's really bothering me and everything. And He usually gives me all the answers, so I've been doing pretty good on my own.
So you sure are a spiritual person?
Yes.
I want to comment about what Will said. We've got a caller named Will. He said that it's all about fear of the unknown, putting them in institutions, closing institutions, discrimination, finding labels. We still do it to a large extent. It's about fear. It's all about fear, and you know, interaction brings enlightenment. But you know, I'm sad to say that often fear or the avoidance of fear is how we got into the situation, and sadly, fear is what guides most of our lives, most of our institutions, and that's my two cents and Will's two cents. Rachel?
Well, there is a countervailing force, which is conscience.
Yeah.
There's fear and there's conscience, and if you're a person who really has a strong conscience and you believe in doing the right thing, even when the world is against you, you will do the right thing. And I know you said the story of Beautiful Girls about love. It's also about acts of conscience and people against all odds doing what they know is the right thing to do.
Well, and we also know that faith cures fear, and so does love. It just opens your heart and allows you to do the right thing for yourself and for the larger community. Well, I've got great thanks for all three of you. And by the way, Jean, I found out that you've been working for all these years?
Yes, I forgot to tell you, I've been working for a law firm for 17 years called the Disability Rights Network.
Yeah, I know them. Well, the fact that you've been working means, according to the rules, that you have to take me out to lunch.
That's fine.
It's just the way the rules go. Okay.
That's fine.
All right.
You pick the place.
All right. We've been talking with Jean Searle, who's a long-term self-advocate and obviously a force in the disability rights movement. Jean, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And we've also been joined by Jim Conroy. He's the founder and president of the Center for Outcome Analysis and really a scholar and tremendous knowledge base about Pennhurst and the inhumane treatment people have received over time. Jim, thanks so much for joining.
Thank you.
And Rachel, what can I say to you? You are a blessing. This book, you know, I have said, is the best book I've ever read, fiction or nonfiction. And I just thank you on behalf of not just people with all disabilities, but on behalf of all humans. I thank you for putting this out in the world. So that's who my guests are. Next week on Voices in the Family, we're going to be rebroadcasting the show with author Stephanie Kuntz. If you've got a question or show idea, we're at voices@whyy.org. The engineer has been Al Banks. Elizabeth Perez Luna is our executive producer of audio content. Mike and Scott's our executive producer. Jennifer Lynn is our producer. Our interns are Emily Haas and Evan Pliss. Me, I'm Dan Gottlieb. Enjoy your week, my friends.